So that was the position that this guy was in when he came out with the line. George Montgomery and I were doing a scene in this movie that Ward had a great deal to do with, and they said that, you know, well, you know, we just we want him to give you the envelope. And yet he's a little embarrassed about doing it, and he doesn't know how to quite get into the conversation, so you kind of got to ad-lib between the two of you. Well, George and I had worked together, so we're in the bathroom. They cut most of this out, but I come flying into the men's room, you see, and I'm lifting the apron, and over my shoulder I'm saying, I've been waiting to get in here all night, you know. I was the bartender, you see. All right, now I'm at the urinal, and they had the camera in a booth, shining into, photographing into a mirror, so that my back was now to the camera, because I'm at the urinal, and my back is to the mirror. Montgomery comes in, and he stops in front of the mirror at the sink, and he's washing his hands, you see. And washes his face, and I look over my shoulder, and at this point, I did have a written line. The line was, "You look like hell," and he had a written line, and his line was, "Well, I can." Don't worry about me, and then something about I had a line something like, "Boy, I wouldn't let you drive a kiddie car around the block." You see? Oh, no, he said, "I can still drive." And I said, "I wouldn't let you drive a kiddie car around the block." And at this point, I'm supposed to be finished at the urinal and go over and to either stand at the sink or start to walk out, you see. You know, I don't want to anticipate the fact that he's got a line to me to pull me back. So now Soundman was on his knees, holding the door open, because the door wouldn't stay open, and I'm supposed to be able to make an exit out that door. So he's down low, below camera angle, and I start to head for the door, and Montgomery gets upset that I'm going out. He hasn't finished the scene. He says, "Wait a minute." I said, "What? What do you want?" He says, "Wash your hands." And I turned to him directly into the mirror, so I knew I was full on camera. Because I was now turned into the mirror. I'm such a ham. Turned directly into the mirror. And I said, "What for? Alcohol kills everything." And of course, the sound man just toppled right over. He fell right off his knees. You know, he was on his heels, you know.
Well, how did you get started in show business?
I know it's hard to believe, but I was a beautiful baby. And... and my mother was wheeling me down the boardwalk in Coney Island, and somebody came by and spotted me, and I was on some baby food package. And so it started with a modeling career. I also am related. I'm a second cousin to George Burns, whose real name is Nathan Birnbaum. And my real name is Murray Birnbaum. So, and although I didn't meet George until I must have been about eight or nine years old, the first time I met him and Gracie. And they came to my grandmother's house. By the time I was four, I was doing shows.
What kind of show?
I did a show on Second Avenue in New York in the Jewish Theater. And I remember the line. I came running in, screaming, "The Rebbetzin hat had twins. The rabbi's wife had twins." But at any rate, I then became very, very popular on radio. I had some shows that just played endlessly. I was on Let's Pretend for 14 years on Saturday mornings. Most Saturday mornings. I might have missed four or five a year, or if I was on the road. I was Sammy on the Goldbergs for 11 years, from the time I was 7 until I was 18. And then they wrote me into the Army. When I came back from overseas after USO shows, Gertrude Berg had a TV show at that time, and she used me on the TV show, but not as Sammy. She used me once as a repairman who came up to repair the washing machine, and another time as a butcher down the street with whom she tried to make a shidduch with a great niece of hers. And she tried to pair us off. And marvelous person, marvelous woman. And during that period, I did things like I was the oldest son on Helen Menken's second husband. I did Grand Central Station about 30 times. I did The Shadow about 6 or 8 times. Presented by Blue Coal, I think. Yeah. would you believe we broadcast that from the old Minsky Theater up on top of the the Ziegfeld Theater on 42nd Street in Broadway, and the other shows. I'm trying to remember some of them. Occasionally, I was on Big Sister. One time, I had a part on the O'Neills, and funny thing, it was St. Patrick's Day, and I had to run from CBS to NBC, and you have to cross Fifth Avenue. And I got to Fifth Avenue. There's the St. Patrick's Day parade, and this great big Irish cop on duty. And I stepped my foot out in the gutter. He says, "Hold it there." He says, "Now you got to go up to 96th Street. You want to cross the street up to 96th Street with you." And this was like 50th Street, you know. And I was just a kid. I was like 11 years old, you know. And I said, 96th Street? I said, I can't walk that far. I said, not only that, but I don't have the time. I got to be at the radio station in 15 minutes for rehearsal. He says, at the radio station for rehearsal. And just what show would you be rehearsing? I said, why, I'm going to be on the O'Neills. He says, the O'Neills, is it? Well, just a moment, we'll get you there on time. And he steps into the middle of the gutter, he blows the whistle, and he stops, and he's walking me across the street, and he says, and what show did you just come from? I told him I was coming from another station. He said, what show did you just do? I said, the Goldbergs. He said, the Goldbergs, up to 96th Street. But he was kidding, and he got me across the street. Crazy little bits. Anyway, my great desire had been to play Richard in Our Wilderness, and I never got to play it because I never was a juvenile. I was a character juvenile, and Richard was a straight juvenile role, so I never did get to play it. I did, by a miracle, get to play George in Our Town. And I played it opposite Martha Scott, with whom I was madly in love, even though she was an older woman. and there on opening night at the New York City Center, my ladder fell during the window scene. And I went crashing down, and fortunately I didn't hurt myself. But she stayed right in character. She said, George, are you all right, George? Did you hurt yourself? And I put the ladder up, and as I'm climbing up the ladder, I said, I'm fine, Emily. I'm going to have to tell my dad to fix that window sash. And we went right on with the thing. But we did get a hand from the audience before. crazy things have happened.
Yeah. When did you first start playing in traveling shows then?
I think I was about 14 when I was barking up a girly show in Coney Island. And then I decided that there was more money on the inside selling the candy that never really had the prizes in them. The and that was fine until some of the people began to throw the candy at me. The because that stuff was hard as a rock. You couldn't eat it. So I decided, well, I'm going to be one of the comics, you see. And and I became a burlesque comic, and I played on the Hearst circuit in burlesque. And in the meantime, I had done vaudeville. I had played the in New York, they had vaudeville at the Lowe's Theaters in those days, and at the RKO Theaters. I think we had Lowe's on Wednesdays and Fridays, RKO's on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And
what's the difference? Can you tell me the difference between vaudeville and burlesque?
The difference is vaudeville was strictly acts and no chorus line. Burlesque had a chorus line, and it had skits, or what you call sketches, rather than individual acts. And when we traveled with a burlesque show, each theater had its own line. It's like today, each theater has its own resident company, and they bring in star system, you see. Each theater had its own line, but the comics and the feature attractions. and the feature attraction wasn't always a stripper. Sometimes it was an exotic act. It could have been anything. They traveled. They toured the circuit. But many of the time we used a girl in the local house to fill out the compliment for a sketch.
What, you were a comic?
Yeah.
What were some of the sketches
that you were... Oh, God. we did Dr. Cronkite. We did... Muchacho. We did the Slowly I Turned, which another name for that is Venice. And every time the guy hears the word Venice, he goes crazy, you see. Goes absolutely nuts. And he keeps beating up on the little guy, you know. And so finally, the little guy decides he's going to take it out of someone else. He gets rid of this guy, and he starts to tell someone else about this thing. He uses the same story, but in a burlesque version of the story. And when he gets the word Venice, and the other guy says Venice, instead of him turning and beating up the other guy, the first one comes out, the original comes out, and beats the hell out of him again, you know? And that's the blackout. And there's all kinds of blackout things. We had one blackout sketch where I come in, and I say to the wife, "So, where's my dinner?" And she says, "Where's your dinner? Where's your dinner? Look, do you see the clothes hanging?" She says, "All the clothes." She says, "I had to wash the clothes. All day long I'm washing clothes from five children, you know. And all day long I'm cooking for five children. All day long I'm taking care of five children. I'm sewing for five children." I said, "I don't want to hear that bunk. Now where the heck is my dinner?" So she says, "I'm not going to make you any dinner if you don't shut up and give me a time to breathe." I said, "Oh, the heck with it. I'm going down and have a drink with the boys or something like that. Goodbye, mother of five." And she follows, and I slam the door, and she follows me to the door, and she says, "Goodbye, father of none." That was the blackout. You know, there were gags, really, with punchlines.
Did you work a team, like with someone else?
Yeah, at one time I had a partner who was known as Leo. He later achieved fame as Leo the Lion. And... but by that time, I was into serious drama, and which is really what I prefer. I do drama, and sometimes I do it passively.
Well, would you write your material for those sketches?
Sometimes we did, and sometimes we used what was standard material, generally spoken in the. There was a sketch, Lamb Chops, that actually George and Gracie had made famous because they did it so much, but they didn't write it. It wasn't theirs. Mm-hmm. Each one adds his own little touch to each little thing that you do. And so they do change, but everybody was stealing material from everybody else.
Now it's just the accepted practice?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. I also had some specialties that I did. I did a very good imitation of Baby Snooks. And I also had acts. I had a dog act at one time. Actually played Radio City Music Hall with it. And the lead dog was just magnificent. When the orchestra, the symphony orchestra, he's conducting, you see, and they'd hit a clinker, you see, he'd go over and bark at the conductor of the orchestra, you see, and then he'd go back to his little thing, step up and tap his baton, and start again. When I met Ward, I had a different kind of a dog show. I had a show of what we called Peruvian monster dogs, which were hairless dogs with the skin of an elephant or a hippopotamus, with a pig's tail, a little curlicue tail, with huge donkey ears, webbed feet like a duck.
I've seen those dogs. They're really rare.
Yes, they do.
Their skin hangs off.
Some of it, yeah. And we had one in particular. She was so old, she'd lost her teeth. And her tongue just hung down. Sometimes she almost stepped on it. but they made me money. I exhibited them. And the funny thing is, people do not understand that when you own an animal that's making you money, you take better care of the animal than you do of yourself. And yet I was constantly harassed by ignorant people who, how can you keep them in cages? You know, that dog just spilled his water. Well, it's all right. I have a boy who goes in every hour, cleans out the cages, you know, and if the water has got, refills the water. But people were just, you know, they just didn't understand. Now, of course, we took the dogs out at night. They ran the ground, so we took them on a big run and played with them and had fun with them, etc. But in the daytime, naturally, they had to be in their cages. But a lot of people came through that show.
When you were doing your sketches, did you ever do a sketch called Pete in the Well? Or the 3 o'clock train?
I remember a Pete in the Well, but I don't remember us doing it. There were another pair of comedians that did Pete in the Well, and we were so much on in the same circuit as they that we tried not to have the same material that they had, and vice versa. But the 3 o'clock train was something about where the guy has to catch the 3 o'clock train, and he keeps meeting these gals, and or his wife is going to meet him at the 3 o'clock train, something like that.
They're in a haunted house, and he keeps saying, he says, "I've got to catch the 3 o'clock train," and the lady says, "Well, you just missed it. You got to spend the night." But the house is haunted, and if he stays the night in the house, he can get the house as an inheritance. But
oh,
he has
boy.
To agree to stay in the house.
That sounds more like an Abbott and Costello thing that that they used to do. And they had some fabulous sketches. They really did.
Did they also steal?
They also stole and wrote and rewrote and they did. Everybody did. Everybody did. But burlesque was a whole different thing then from what it is now. At that time, burlesque was a family-type show. There absolutely were no dirty words. There were implied actions. There were pointed things. but they weren't dirty words. It really was a fun thing. Well, we did the courtroom shows where the judge hits him on the head with the with the gavel, which is not going to hurt him because it's a it's almost a goatskin bag, and we did use a lot of goatskin bags beating people. They made a lot of noise, and I was doing a thing. I was doing a dance out in front. Oh yeah, I used to tap. I was doing a dance out in front when somebody was getting the heck beat out of him behind me, you see. And at the excitement of the audience, I thought it was all for me. You know, at least I'm supposed to think it's all for me, you see. I'm not supposed to know that that this other thing is taking place behind me. And that was part of the sketch.
Well, what does he mention, this Dr. Cronkite sketch?
The Dr. Cronkite sketch is, there are various versions of it. But in the Dr. Cronkite sketch, the patients that come will never get cured. And he works with this nurse, and they do very strange things. But it's all good fun. It's humor, and it's really a great deal of it was slapstick humor, not too much situation comedy. But from a serious situation, and this is where comedy evolves. The comedy evolves from the seriousness of the situation, which we can all feel something with. We can feel something for something that affects everybody. That's universal. Can be a very funny thing when you look at it from another angle. Stuttering, of course, is not a very healthy thing, and it's very embarrassing for the stutterer. But many things were done on stage using a stutter in order to get the laugh across. One of the jokes I used to come out with, especially out in front of the curtain while we're giving the girls time to change, I said, gee whiz, I ran into an old friend of mine today down at NBC. I was just coming out after my show, and I was so surprised to see him. I said, Norman, what are you doing here at NBC? Because I know the guy stutters. And Norman says, oh, hello, Wayne. He says, I'm looking for a job, I'm seeking employment. I said, well, what kind of a job are you looking for? He said, well, I want to be an announcer, a guy who reads commercials. And I said, well, did you get the job? He said, I don't think so. I said, well, why not? He said, well, because of the way I talk, it's my speech, they're anti-Semites. You know, so it lends itself to the humor. But that's the kind of thing that burlesque was.
Did you do a lot of dialect?
Yeah, I do a lot of dialects. I still do. I do some fantastic dialects. Did you like that one?
Being Irish, I like that.
This is the story of the priest and the rabbi, who are the best of friends. And I tell the story because it's inoffensive, and yet, again, it's something that we all can relate to, you see. Very best of friends. They each had their own parish in New York, and they made it a practice every Monday to meet at Central Park at 1 o'clock and go bike riding for about 3 hours until 4 in the afternoon. It gave them exercise, it gave them things to talk about, and it was a very nice thing. They had been to theology school together, and they remained friends all these years. So one Monday, the rabbi pedals into Central Park, to the usual meeting place, and the priest is not there. Well, he pedals around for about half an hour, goes back to the meeting place, still no priest. Finally, about 2:30, he's getting a little worried. After all, Father Kelly has always been there. So he pedals over to the parish house just to make sure everything is okay. And he comes inside, and there's Father Kelly sitting at his desk. He says, my goodness, he says, Father Kelly, I was so worried about you. He says, I thought maybe, God forbid, you got sick. Maybe an accident, God forbid. He says, after all, every Monday we're biking in Central Park. Today you didn't come. What happened? He says, well, he says, first of all, he says, Rabbi Cohen, I want to thank you for being such a friend and having concern for me health. He says, but my health is perfect. He says, the only reason I didn't come is because we had a little bit of a tragedy here. He says, a tragedy? What kind of tragedy? What happened? He says, well, he says, if you must know, somebody stole me bicycle. He says, you don't say. That's terrible. Terrible, he says. You know, he says, a few years ago, we had some thefts around the synagogue. He says, I put a stop to that. Came the Sabbath sermon. I stood up in my pulpit, and I gave a sermon on the whole Ten Commandments. And when I got to the commandment about thou shalt not steal, I made a real strong emphasis on thou shalt not steal. And by Tuesday, everything was put back ready. The priest says, well, that sounds like a marvelous idea. He says, I think I'll do the same thing this Sunday. He says, good, good, good. Following Monday, Rabbi Cohen rides into Central Park, and there's Father Kelly on his bicycle. He says, Kelly, he says, you got back the bicycle. He says, that I did. He says, tell me, he says, you gave our sermon yesterday on the Ten Commandments? He says, well, he says, I started to give that sermon on the Ten Commandments. And I was going to emphasize the one about thou shalt not steal. But when I got to the one about thou shalt not commit adultery, I remembered where I'd left my bicycle. But it has charm.
It is. I mean, you don't hear sketches like that anywhere. It's great. I don't know how you keep the voices straight. God, I would get them all mixed up, though. The Irish and the, you know.
I used to advertise myself as the actor with 27 separate distinct voices. I had 28, but I was holding that one out. But I did things. I had my own radio show by the time I was 16. A show called the Murray Playhouse, and that was done WWRL in Woodside, Long Island. I worked Albany, Glens Falls. Are you from Glens Falls?
I'm from Albany.
Are you from Albany? I used to do a show up there called Luncheon at the Ten Eyck. From WTRY in the Ten Eyck Hotel, right. And this was the corner of State and Pearl. And I used to interview the various dignitaries that came to visit the governor.
I bet my mother... I don't remember it because I didn't listen, but I bet she really... What year would that have been?
Oh, boy. It must have been the 50s, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. And in 1950, I directed theater up there. I had a theater out in Del Mar, which is 4 miles south of Albany, I think. The Del Mar Musical Playhouse. And I directed, we opened... Well, I didn't direct this one. The producer directed this one. I wanted nothing to do with it. But he wanted to open with Sing Out Sweet Land. And we did. We opened with Sing Out Sweet Land. He spent every penny we had on that one. And they stayed away in droves. our next show was Finian's Rainbow. And I had a $19 budget. And the scripts arrived from Tam's Whitmark at the post office with a $450 collect price tag on them. For the sides and the music. We let them sit there. I had a library book from which we copied the sides for everybody. And our musical director went out and bought one copy of the score. The only copy he was able to find was from the English version of Finney's Rainbow. But we had a great musical director, a fellow named Leonard Castle. He was a student of Giancarlo Minotti. And we put on a heck of a show. I begged, borrowed, and stole whatever I had to get that show on. People were very gracious about giving us things for when the idle poor become the idle rich. We had to have fur coats and really fabulous garments. And we had no money for costumes. And our lights had gone bad. Some of our spotlights had blown out, and I needed 1,000-watt bulbs. So at 4 in the morning, I took my stage manager and the biggest ladder we had, And we went out along the roadside at 4 in the morning with two gigantic bath towels, and I held the ladder while he climbed up and unscrewed bulbs, 1,000-watt bulbs from the electrical signs, from the roadside signs. We lit that show. But
this was when then you got into drama and producing shows.
Yeah.
Did you travel with the shows?
I did with some. I traveled with a company of Junior Miss, and also I was involved with the tabloid versions of shows that we began to do around the New York City area, the Respectful Prostitute and some of the other plays that we did. And there I traveled to what we call the subway circuit in New York. There were 4 or 5 theaters that you actually can get to by subway from from anywhere in New York. There was the Windsor Theater in the Bronx, the Flatbush Theater in Brooklyn, I forget the name of the one in Westbury, Long Island, and there was another one in Queens. There were 4 or 5 added to the circuit. And so when you got that, there was 3 weeks of rehearsal and 10 weeks of work. You say, because, you know, 2 weeks in each house. That was a great coup, you know. Let's call one of those. Now, in the meantime, I went to Syracuse. When I was traveling with shows as a kid, I had a private tutor. When I was on the road with the show. When I wasn't on the road with the show, I went to professional children's school. And except for, I think, 4 months, I went to Herman Ritter Junior High School in the Bronx, which I hated. Absolutely detested it. And the kids were so dumb. You know? They were so unknowing, so unknowledgeable, really. And in a way, I suffered, too, because I during my teen years, I really didn't have friends. I was a precocious 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old, and who... I couldn't get